baseball nuts, and a big warm welcome to episode 6 of the Johnny and Josh Baseball Podcast. This is season 3, episode 6. It's extraordinary we've lasted this long. It's indicative of the love that we have for you, for the sport, and for each other. Now, sadly, no Big Dave, it's Labor Day, but I have got joining me on the podcast the legends that are JC, the greatest sporting pundit the world has ever known, and Eric, the producer, who was a very good producer. Not necessarily the best, but a very good one. Boys, lovely to have you here.
Full day. Yeah, you know, this is the day in the U.S. It's kind of like a bank holiday. Everyone goes out, goes to the Barbie, has, you know, a cookout. But for the love of Rich Gedman, I'm missing Langell, you know?
He's been a busy boy, isn't he? Either that or he just finally came to conclusion that he doesn't like us. That's one option. You may have not considered it.
Apparently right now he's in a lakeside cabin with a bunch of screaming kids. I think he'd rather be with us right now. So,
I feel like the show has been weighed and found wanting for David Langell.
Yeah.
I'll find a way that we can sort of squeezing him in, back in. And hey, you never know. We might go rogue one day and do our own show without you guys.
Hey, but hang on. I'm always available. Don't start trying to cut me out. I mean, you know how sad I am. I want to be on everything.
We wanted to be a good show. That's the problem. So, you know.
Well, I mean, the summer is, there's a real sense of the summer slipping away, isn't it? We're into, the beginning of September. We're recording on the 5th of September. We're already almost a week in. The leaves are starting to drop off the tree. I mean, I love this time of year in Britain, if I'm honest. It's usually a little bit colder, but the skies are blue. We don't tend to get that much rain in September. It's a nice time of year, but summer's over, boys.
I'll tell you what makes me sad about September this year compared to other Major League Baseball seasons, bringing back to what the purpose of the show is, which is that in the past, you could open up your whole 40-man roster. And September was a great time where teams would bring up a dozen, you know, 8, 9 minor leaguers who the big leagues. And if you guys ever remember Bull Durham, they talk about, you know, Kevin Costner's character, Crash Davis, talks about his brief time in the major leagues. And that was the old September column. But in the last negotiations between the Players Association and Major League Baseball, they've really severely limited the number of players who are coming up. So it was one of my favorite parts of September, seeing all the young guys or some of the old veterans getting that little taste of Major League Baseball.
Yeah, sad on many levels. And perhaps this is the reason, guys. I can offer some explanation. This is season 6. As you know, we like to kick the podcast off with a biblical reference for those more spiritual amongst us, like myself. And when I was looking up what the number 6 stands for in the Bible, this is the slightly sad thing. It says it's usually a negative connotation in the Bible. For instance, our Lord Jesus Christ suffered on the cross for 6 hours, and men were commanded to work 6 days a week in Exodus, as we know. And in the Greek alphabet, the number 6 is represented by a symbol called the stigma. None of this is particularly good. I'm wondering if this is the problem. Should we just call this episode 6A, just to get beyond it? What do you think?
Well, what does it say in you did your biblical reference here, but what does it say in the Torah and the Quran?
Well, that is a very good point. And we like to appeal to all, as you're rightly. So if you just want to chat amongst yourselves, I'm just going to go on Google.
No, we're good. I think we're good with religion at the moment. Let's stick with the religion of baseball, the Church of Baseball.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Church of Baseball, and let's talk about notable number 6s from baseball past. Some big favorites here, JC. I'm particularly thinking Bobby Cox, legendary main man with the Atlanta Braves.
Well, I think it's interesting. Two managers retired at number 6. You got Bobby Cox and, of course, Joe Torre. But clearly the greatest number 6 of all time is Stan Musial. Stan the man, probably the greatest, one of the greatest players of all time. And but my personal favorite, Steve Garvey, number 6 for the Dodgers. That was my childhood. You know, there are always those players who were good, not great, but just happened to be in that certain time and place in your life. I'm sure there's some Chelsea footballer who, you know, represents, who wasn't necessarily the greatest, but a very good one. That was Steve Garvey for me growing up in Los Angeles in the late 70s, early 80s.
One thing I wanted to mention as well, that Steve Garvey, Johnny, has a record for most consecutive games played. Did you know that?
Is that right?
Yeah.
What record?
The record for most Major League Baseball consecutive baseball games played.
No, it isn't.
Yes, he does. In the National League.
has. Well,
okay.
I remember when he broke the other guy. Was it William Scott? I forget the name of the player he broke. But
was it Billy Williams? Billy Williams from Chicago Cubs.
No way.
Okay, fine. Well, we'll find out. We'll have to look it up later.
Exactly. We're like, the put a pin in looking up things later, because now that's coming back, right?
I don't know how you're saying this with any confidence, JC. We discussed this very issue, consecutive games played, on the last podcast. It was, if you remember, Eric's Trivia. And if I remember, you got it wrong, and I got it right.
Well, are we going to break that seal?
No. Before we can still stay with the Sixes, because you forgot another player that was very iconic.
Al Kaline.
Al Kaline, or is, you know, not Alkaline, as some people say, but Al Kaline, the Detroit Tigers, famous number six. You know, and
he passed away last year, if I remember.
He did indeed.
Yeah, acidic personality, I understand.
Cha-cha-cha.
And I just like to say,
he took a wicket and kept on ticking, right? That's an American.
I think we should point out, given the fact he did die last year, that was only a joke, and he was a phenomenal player, and I'm sure a very lovely human being. But Stan the man, he was the main man. Would you say top 10 all time?
I think arguably, yeah. I mean, amongst national leaguers, for sure, right? You know, I mean, we live in a different era now where it doesn't matter what league you play in, but there was a real definite character between the National and American League, and he was one of the true greats of the National League.
And also, he has a stadium named after him in, of all places,
Kutno
in Poland, because he is, of course, of Polish descent, and they built a baseball stadium in Poland, and they came because it was named after Stan Musial.
I played at that stadium. When I played 1 year professionally in Sweden, we did spring training in Poland, which seems a little different, probably, played at that field.
Yeah, the best field. Pierogies and cabbage rolls in the land, that's for sure. So, yes.
You guys have got great stories. I could sit here for hours and listen to those stories. We need to move it on, though, swiftly. We need a COVID update. And there's a great story about Jeremiah Estrada. For those of you out there that perhaps not as familiar with Jeremiah as perhaps you'd like to be, in August 2019, he underwent Tommy John surgery, which is pretty major for any pitcher. In August 2021, he was hospitalized and nearly died from COVID. So August is not his favorite month. Until now, JC.
Yeah, got his big league opportunity, right, Goldie?
Yeah, pitching Cubs v Blue Jays. And I think he pitched pretty damn well, didn't he, from all accounts?
Came in for a few innings. And the important thing is he's back in the majors and he's alive and kicking.
Yeah, that's a great story. Love it. Best of luck to Jeremiah. I hope his career goes well. What's the update, certainly, with regards to the Canadian border, Eric? Are they still keeping us out if you haven't had the vaccine?
It's only keeping you out if you don't have the vaccine. And at the moment, as it stands, at the time of recording, you know, there's still a vaccine mandate, passports needed for entering Canada until September 30th. Question mark. Maybe they'll extend it. Maybe they won't. But if they do extend it, and the Blue Jays do make the playoffs, bear this in mind. Let's picture this scenario. Not impossible, but imagine a St. Louis Cardinals Toronto Blue Jays World Series. Okay.
Yeah.
Two major anti-vaxxers and holdouts with the Cardinals, Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado.
No.
Yeah. So imagine getting the World Series. What would happen? You know,
they'd lose.
Well,
fans would hate them. So. They'd run them out of town.
Actually, I think it would be polarizing, though, in the United States. It'd be people that would call them "quote unquote" patriots for doing what they did.
That's a problem. They're probably considered
sad
murders.
State of affairs. Yeah, sad state of affairs. But
as our listeners can probably gather, we're very pro-vaccine on this podcast. But we're not trying to suggest that we know it all. But on this occasion, I think we do. Anyway, let's not get too serious on the matter. We've got your trivia question next, Eric.
I do indeed. Now, last month, whatever our last show was, you were gloating about beating Josh.
Rightly so.
And there's a discrepancy. Now, Josh sort of did his own research after I thought I did my research. And he came back to me and he went, "Wait a minute, Eric."
Okay, just remind our listeners what was the trivia question.
Well, let's rewind the clock back to last show. This is what happened. Cue, roll that tape.
Moving on, answer time to the trivia question. Do you want to repeat the trivia for our listeners, Eric?
Yes, indeed. I asked you earlier on the show, who is the current active leader in most consecutive games played in Major League Baseball? And I asked you, is it A, Matt Olson, B, Dansby Swanson, and or C, Austin Riley?
Can I go first?
Yes, you can go first.
I'm going with Matt Olson.
But I actually think it's Dansby Swanson.
Matt Olson.
Come on, buddy!
249.
Yes! Yay! Yes! I'm beating Josh! Ladies and gentlemen, stop the world. I want to get off. I've beaten JC in a Braves trivia competition.
All right, so here's the deal. So after this was all done, I was like, I feel like Matt Olson did not play in every game last year. I went to baseballreference.com, indispensable site for anyone who doesn't use it. I highly recommend it, baseball-reference.com. And saw that Matt Olson only played 156 games last year, as opposed to the full 162 games.
What?
Whereas Dansby Swanson played in every game last season. So I don't understand where this streak came from. I did do some research and saw there were some articles because, you know, Eric just reads the articles. He doesn't go down and do his own.
Wait a minute.
So let me just get this straight. Eric came up with a question, researched the answer, got it wrong. I got the wrong answer, but was told I was right. So celebrated, understandably. You, even when you're wrong, Josh, are right. That's what you're saying. Yes?
I don't understand the logic that you're going through, but I just know that you were smarmy.
You
started getting pointy. You started like going, I'm better. And
I was
and it turned out once again. Gouldy, you found your level.
I did. You're right. But we've done this show. I mean, how many shows have we done? This is our third season. Okay. And I don't think I've ever beaten you. Well, of course I'm going to celebrate. Of course I'm getting swamped.
No, I got the floor. By the way, I forgot to buy a waffle today.
I was about to say, there's no waffle. Yes. I got a topic.
Usually I wave a waffle saying we're waffling too much here. Now, here's the thing. I'm going to award nul point, no points to either of you, because I'll now have to double check this research and see if that I actually get that question wrong or right, or did Johnny get me? You know what I'm saying? Because as much as I respect Josh doing his own research of saying, wait a minute, Johnny got that question wrong, I need to quadruple check that now. And I mean, to tune in next show and find out.
I mean, I'm trying to make good podcasting here, but the reality is I brought it to you, Eric, saying I don't think the answer was right because of the research. Now, I don't know what sort of loophole would work in Matt Olson's favor here, but the numbers seem to suggest a reputable.
Just see, what we have here is quite simple. He can't take responsibility for getting it wrong. He is in denial. Okay, he is a typical.
Let's move on to maybe a question that might be right this time around, okay? And I will now regale you with this new trivia question, which deals with pitchers getting 10 or more strikeouts in a game.
Oh.
Now basically the all-time leader of most 10-plus strikeouts in a game is Nolan Ryan with 215.
Wow.
215 games where he had 10 or more strikeouts.
Okay.
Second place is not far behind, 212, and that was Randy Johnson.
I was going to say Randy Johnson.
Yeah. Okay. So my question to you is, who is in third place?
Okay.
With most strikeouts, games with 10 or more strikeouts. Okay. Is it A, Pedro Martinez?
Okay.
Or is it B, Max Scherzer?
Wow.
Or is it C, Roger Clemens?
Ooh.
Where's the third place?
Okay, I already had a name, and I just thought, is he going to mention him? And you did. So okay. I already know who I'm going with.
And hopefully the research is right. Moving on.
Well, just before we do move on, a quick mention to obviously our big social media signups. We need you to get involved. I'm pointing at the bottom because apparently there are switches down there where you hit the like and you notify and you tell everybody and you write to your parents and tell them I found this great podcast. We need your support, guys. The YouTube videos are back, so do watch them, do subscribe, do check out our channel. But most important of all, we need your interaction just to make out that we're vaguely popular and people like to listen. It'd be great. Okay,
there's a lot of insecurity in this podcast.
There is. Oh, 100%. Yeah. But I think people relate to that. I think they associate with that. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Hit that bell, Eric.
I did. Moving on.
Okay. It's time for our first and hopefully not only batter up. Here it is. Traditionally, it's the news roundup. So what big news stories made the headlines of late? Well, we're going to kick things off for all you White Sox fans that apparently, and this is never something anybody wants to celebrate, Tony La Russa, legendary team manager, is out for the rest of the season. Apparently has a heart condition. I don't know a great deal about the details, JC, but on the assumption that Tony's going to be fine, because that's the most important thing, is this, from a baseball perspective, good news for the White Sox?
Well, it's going to have an impact one way or the other. I mean, the expectation, right, is that the White Sox have underperformed horrifically. I think that at the time of this recording, they're right at 500. Shockingly, despite winning as many games as they've lost or losing as many games as they've won, they're still in the race for the American League Central. So they still have a chance. Now, either the team rallies around this fact and there are things we don't know about the clubhouse. I know in the past, there was a lot of criticism of La Russa internally, or there was rumblings of that. So there's a lot of reason to think, okay, he's gone. We can sort of play a lot of pressure on Miguel Cairo, who's the bench coach who's sort of taken it over. But it'll be interesting to watch because this is a team that has the talent certainly to go to the postseason, if not make a little bit of noise there.
It gives us a chance to talk AL Central. And I have to say, Eric, I mean, there's always one division every season that just stinks the place up. I mean, you got Cleveland at the top, tied with Minnesota with a 5-15 record. And Cleveland have lost their last five games as of today's recording, the 5th of September. And they've gone 2-8 in their last 10. I mean, it's almost as if no one wants to win the AL Central.
However, the White Sox, you know, since La Russa has gone on indefinite medical absence leave, they're 4-1. So you never know. You know, this is crunch time now. We got till October 5th, you know, until, you know, the regular season ends. Anything can happen.
Well,
there's some good talent on that team. I mean, really, Eloy Jimenez is a fantastic player. A lot of guys who have skill, you know, they have to stay healthy. It's been a team that has had health issues. But, you know, it's hard. I don't want to criticize, you know, none of us are in that seat, the hot seat, as being a manager. And so it's always hard to say, you know, what that life is like. But there's no doubt that La Russa has made some choices this season that have seemed very vexing and weird. Intentional walks in strange times. It's, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether the team can kind of rally around the fact he's not there.
The team ace surely is Giolito, and he has stunk the place up. Do you blame La Russa for his performances, or is there a more underlying issue there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, that's a big team and an organization issue when a pitcher kind of goes off the boil like that, because I often think that they're mechanical factors, if not injuries. So you really only have two choices typically for that. Either injury, you know, you have dead arm, it's that time of the season, or you somehow lost your way mechanically. And that's where your pitching coach, less so your manager, your pitching coach, other people in the organization should be able to see that and help the pitcher get back on the, you know, the straight and narrow. And we've seen teams that are so good at that, right? The Tampa Bay Rays are famous for taking pitchers, making mechanical tweaks.
Yeah.
The third issue that can sometimes come up is that you start relying on one pitch that isn't as effective as it has been in the past. And that's an analytics issue often, where you start to realize, okay, the two-seam fastball is getting hit a lot harder. You're using it 60% of the time. You need to drop that to about 40% of the time and maybe go with the slider or go with, you know, the splitter or something else. So those are really the three ways in which you can look at a pitcher and try and figure out how to get them going again. So I'm not sure that's a La Russa issue, but it may be an organizational issue.
Well, But as a fantasy baseball manager whose season's been destroyed by Giolito, I will point out that he seems to be able to get through three or four innings with absolutely no damage, but then just has an absolute implosion around the sort of inning five or inning six. That seems to be the regular problem. I don't know how to explain it, because the boy's a superstar. There's no question. He's got the material to be an ace. But anyway, that's just me moving talking on. Fantasy baseball. I apologize.
Can I also say that I think I've resolved the fact now that the Tigers will not make the wild card. Moving on.
You pick them to win the series, right?
I think
I never said that.
No, he said they'd win the division. Yeah,
I didn't even say that. Moving on.
Okay. Fall of the Evil Empire up next. Yankees have gone 10-18 in August, guys. First half of the season, they had the best record of Major League Baseball. The big question, do you now believe in the curse of Joey Gallo? Who, of course, despite the fact they moved him onto the Dodgers because everybody said he was so awful with the Yankees. And yet, even with the Dodgers, I think he's only hitting, 183 since he's arrived? Hit, I think, 3 home runs. But the Dodgers are at least winning. Whereas when he was with the Yankees, I mean, it was just horrific.
He was horrific, but the Yankees were good.
And then, yeah, but Gallo's a 201 lifetime hitter. I mean, you know, the expectation for him is pure power, and his OPS plus, which is if you have a 100 OPS plus, that means your league average. He was below league average with the Yankees. He's now at 101. So he's slightly above average. So don't look at batting average. That's not really a good reflection of his value. He's definitely given a modest value added to the Dodgers. But the Yankees have other issues, right? The injuries, Luis Severino, you have Giancarlo Stanton, who's not playing well. Carpenter got injured. I mean, I think there are a lot of factors that are leading to this. And I don't think it's time to push the panic button with this team yet. There's so much pressure in New York. I watched that documentary series on Derek Jeter, and that I found a little self-serving for Jeter, which is fine. But it was just interesting looking at it from the perspective of playing in New York, that it just, when things kind of go south, the pressure grows so great. It's one of the few cities left in the United States where you have multiple tabloids. You have the Post, the New York Post, and the Daily Mail. And every day they can really apply the pressure and people are paying attention. So I think if the Yankees can rally, you know, circle the wagons, and realize, okay, we're a better team than we're playing, they're going to be just fine. They're going to be in the postseason and they're going to be competitive.
So in reality, the word curse is the wrong word. Ultimately, Joey Gallo, no matter how bad he is, when he plays for a team, that team seems to do well. You think actually in reality, it's just a sheer coincidence?
I'm not a superstitious guy, Gouldy. That's just not my bag in baseball. It's just, I know there are people who love that. They love the curse of the Bambino. They love the black cat, the Billy Goat curse with the Cubs. Curses only exist if you believe them, right? I can't imagine that the judge is thinking to himself, yes, if only Joey Gallo was here, we'd be winning.
Well, Judge has started to turn things around because he went horribly cold. I think he's now hit 53. So is that a record for him? I think it is, isn't it? That's the most he's ever hit in one season. We've still got, a month still to go. Can he chase down 61?
Yeah, I mean, this is a question, right? Like, people are discussing, if he surpasses Roger Maris, obviously he'll have the Yankees record for a single season, which is pretty amazing for a team of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and all of that. But some people are arguing maybe there should be an asterisk on all the home runs that surpassed Maris, because they all came, whether it was Sammy Sosa or Barry Bonds or Mark McGwire, they all came during the steroids era. I don't buy that. I think they are what they are, but I think that you're going to have certainly that argument that if Judge gets to 62 or 63, that he is the all-time home run champ for a single season.
Guys, you know I'm not a big fan of an asterisk, but I have to say this is one time when I would be in favor, because there is just no way any of those hitters, as good as they were career-wise, had they not done the steroids, would have hit the numbers they hit. So as far as I'm concerned, Roger Maris still does have the record, and if Judge beats him, it should be honored.
Gouldy, we can have this discussion every single show if you like, but I sort of think you have to take the steroids era as in the context of steroids, but understand that that's the way baseball was played then. In the same way that you look at Babe Ruth when he hit 60 home runs in 1927 and there were no African-American players, does he hit 60 home runs if he's facing Satchel Paige? No, it's pre-Satchel Paige, but, Bullet Rogan, whoever the pitcher was from the Negro Leagues at that time, and having a lot of them there. There are a lot of factors that go into each of these eras that set them apart, and you just got to take them as they are. That's my opinion.
Well, as always, buddy, you're always very well informed. You'll be well informed to know that the Yankees have gone 10 and 18 in August. And the one thing I will ask you, that, by the way, is the worst single month they've had since 1991. That is 31 years ago. One question for you, Eric. How much would you love to see the Rays catch the Yankees and take the title of the AL East?
That's the thing. I mean, all because it'd be a great story. I mean, the Rays were one game away from sweeping them yesterday. So at the moment, the Yankees in September are only 1-2. And along may the, I don't know, the curse continue if you do believe in the Joey Gallo curse.
Well, the
I just want to say real quickly, because this is the question, honest question. Are the Rays the best organization in baseball? I mean, really think about it, that year in, year out, that they're competitive. I mean, we talked about Billy Bean and Moneyball and the A's, who ping pong up and down, have these horrible seasons. Year in, year out, with no fan base, with, you know, they don't have the big market money.
Crappy stadium, they find
a way. And I it's so hard to root for them just because they're the Tampa Bay Rays. But man, you should, because they're amazing. They're amazing.
I mean, guys, if they're still in the hunt, Toronto's only one game back of them. They, as of broadcast, we're broadcasting the 5th of September, the Rays are five games back of the Yankees with a whole month to go. Toronto are only six games back. Baltimore are only 8.5 games back.
Now, we'll love it. Moving on.
Okay. Okay. Well, we wish them the best. And obviously for all our Yankee fans out there that... You know, they are the evil empire, so it is what it is. Moving on. Right, let's talk about Albert's, as in Mr. Pujols. Now, I believe, as of the 5th of September, he's on 695 career home runs. So the big question, will he reach 700 by the last game of the regular season on October the 5th? What do you reckon, JC?
I mean, the odds are against it. I've definitely seen a lot of the charts that sort of project where his potential home runs and the percentages of it, and getting five more in the last month, considering the amount of time he's playing, seems to be a long time. I really wish David Langell was here, our good friend David, because, you know, typical David, he's like, Albert Pujols is boring. I'm like, what are you talking about? This is just a fun story, guy at his end of his career. And I'll tell you what turned it around. If you watch the home run derby when Pujols was in it, started that home run derby sort of very kind of lackadaisical, sort of that slow bat he had seen to have. And all of a sudden something clicked in him and he started hitting bombs. And I honestly felt like we always talk about the home run derby as this event that makes players diminish in terms of their power because you change your swing all of a sudden to try and hit the bombs. I feel with Albert that that was the turning point, that home run derby, that there was some spark inside of him that got reignited. And that's the reason why he's had this amazing second half.
You said it, that, you know, will he play enough? Surely if he gets a couple, and he's capable of hitting two in one night, if he gets a couple and really gets close to 700, is there not going to be pressure on the management to say, okay, look, give him a bit more game time?
Well, I mean, the Cardinals are in the hunt, and that's the problem, right? If they were the Red Sox this year, you know, the Tigers, one of those teams, absolutely, you'd roll them out there every day and give them a shot. But I don't know whether with the Cardinals still in the hunt, it's going to be the same.
Yeah, buddy, the Cardinals are 8.5 games ahead of Milwaukee. You know, they could lose a few and it won't really make that much difference. I think they've won 8-2 last 10. They're a four-game win streak. I mean, I don't think there's any danger. I do not see the Brewers getting anywhere near them.
What team says that, though? I mean, I get it once you clinch. So, to your point, Goldie, if they clinch, maybe you roll them out every day. Until you clinch, you do not take the foot off the accelerator. It's just that's the nature of baseball.
Okay. Will he be the last person, before we move on from this? Eric, I'm interested in your opinion as well. As a great study of the history of baseball, will he be the last person to get to 700 home runs in our lifetime? When you consider Giancarlo Stanton, who's age 32, is on only 371. He's just over the halfway mark. He's 32. He's a broken flush. Love Giancarlo when he's fit, but he's never fit. We're never going to see another 700 home run hitter, are we?
Not in your lifetime.
Not in the next 3 to 4 years.
But no, like you said, I think Giancarlo is possibly the only one who might. But like you said, he's always injured. I doubt it. Will it be Aaron Judge if he keeps this pace? 700 is our, I mean, let's face it, Will, I think it'll be at least another generation till we see anyone hitting 700.
Yeah, you need a freak, right? You need a freak who stays healthy and somehow is able to maintain their ability in the second half of their career.
Aaron Judge gets injured,
Right, which was, we saw that in the steroids era where you could maintain muscle mass as you got into your mid and late 30s. And if you didn't tear your back because you were freakishly muscular for your body, you could actually put up the numbers in the second half. But finding those players, they're few and far between. I mean, that's what made Hank Aaron so special, was that it wasn't just that he was such a consistent home run hitter, not just in the first half of his career. He just never let up. He was still hitting, you know, at the end of his career, 25 home runs. He never sort of fell off the cliff. Yeah. And that's those players are so unique that they're able to maintain that.
He's still the career home run hitter. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not interested in anybody else's name. He's still the man. And by the way, as we move on to the next subject, if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, Eric, people are going to play this podcast back after what you've just said, and you're going to live with the shame and the knowledge that you knocked me off before my time.
but Gouldie, think about how many hits we'd get. I mean, it would be your best podcast
ever. Yeah, yeah.
I'll take one for the team, boys. One for the team. Absolutely. Anyway, let's move it on. This is something that really appeals to me. Great story. Mickey Mantle baseball card sells for $12.6 million. And now officially the world's most expensive sports memorabilia. Boys, you know, in my day-to-day life now, this is what I deal with. Sports memorabilia on a regular basis in charity auctions. So this fascinates me. And I understand previous to this, Maradona's shirt from the Hand of God game, Argentina v England, was the previously most expensive piece of sports memorabilia, now been taken to the cleaners. I did an article on this, by the way, a while back. I think it was last year, and it astounded me how in the top 10 of most expensive pieces of sports memorabilia ever sold, something like 7 were baseball.
Yeah, I think that number will end up being eclipsed, because historically the card that has been considered the most rare and difficult card to get in good condition was the T206 Honus Wagner card from the early part of the 20th century. And the reason for that was that it was the way baseball cards used to be sold was not with bubble gum, but they were sold with tobacco. And right. Honus Wagner did not smoke. And so a card was made of him to go along with cigarettes. He did not like that. And so it was an incredibly short run, Honus Wagner being one of the great players of all time. And that card historically had been the highest seller. I don't know if one has just not come up for auction in a long time, but I wouldn't be surprised if that ends up surpassing the Mickey Mantle, which is, those two cards are really considered the holy grail of baseball card collecting, which is something, as you guys know, I was huge and I sold my whole collection. And now I've started to pick up cards again because, you know, the itch has come back. So yeah, it's amazing that, you know,
there's a cream for that, by the way.
So I'm just going to keep moving past that because it sounds very lubricanty and I don't.
So a friend told me anyway. Exactly. Yeah. Are you guys aware? You may not be aware. I am led to believe that I hold the world record for selling the most expensive cricket bat and the most expensive set of golf clubs. Did you know that?
And who are the owners of said cricket bat and golf clubs?
The cricket bat that I sold in auction for £100,000 was the bat used by MS Dhoni when India won the Cricket World Cup, and he hit a 6 to win the match with that bat. And I sold it.
Can we talk for a second? Because you guys ever watch Antiques Roadshow, right?
Love it. Yeah, of course we do. Okay,
so there is such a disparity between what Americans think that antiques and nostalgic pieces are worth versus people from the UK. So £100,000, that's like, you know, one person's cleat in the US from a boot that they wore in one game. Americans will drop serious dosh for their memorabilia in the way the British do. And so my wife and I, Jen and I, we always watch like Antiques Roadshow, like, oh, this is a beautiful piece, like selling in the UK. We value it at £120. And you go to the US, it's like, oh, that's $132,000. You know, the Americans love to throw money at antiques. Maybe it's a newer country. They're, you know, the British are blasé about history.
I don't know if it's blasé. We're just, you know, we have a greater appreciation of the value of things in life.
Now I go, by the way, you have to tell me who the golf clubs were belong to.
The golf clubs were actually at an auction. This is actually quite a sad story. Put together by Seviano Ballesteros when he was dying of brain cancer. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do.
He got a brain tumor and very sadly died. But before he died, he did an amazing thing. He set up a foundation in his memory to raise money for the research. He went into partnership with Cancer Research UK to raise money for research into brain cancer. And his first event that he was due to be at, because he was still very much alive and well, not well, but alive, but unfortunately, he couldn't make it because his health had deteriorated so much. But everyone there were massive golf fans and famous golfers and everyone, because they loved him so much, they wanted to support him. And he put together this set of golf clubs that was in his bag, that was one of his Ryder Cup bags, beautifully embossed with his name and all the detail. And in the bag was a club from every true great of the modern era that he'd written to. So they'd all sent him a club they'd used in a major and that they were known for. And they'd signed the club heads. And so this bag was full of, you know, of Gary Player, of Jack Nicklaus, Palmer, all the greats, Nick Faldo, Colin Montgomery, you name it, all the greats. And you know, Palmer said, I think, a 1957 Callaway putter, because he was renowned as a great putter. Tiger Woods sent
how
a
much?
That went for 100 grand. That went for 100 grand. Yeah.
Again,
I would have gone higher.
Goldie. I mean, seriously, in the UK, you could get things for a steal. So you could turn that around at,
But the guy who bought it was the guy who bought it was sitting at the back, and I had no idea who he was. So I called him the Hackney Hacker, playing off 24. You know, lucky to go around the Richmond pitch and putt. And he was up against the Wentworth Golf Club table, which is the posh boys. And I was giving it large. It's the posh boys and the bloke at the back who plays off 24. And you know, he's only taking on Wentworth because he wanted to join the club, but they told him
who
they
was
it? It turns out he was, I don't know his name, but he was an Irish billionaire who has his own golf club in Cork. And now all those clubs are in individual boxes all around the club. And he was such a big fan of Seve, and this is his little plaything. His mates are the members, you know, they don't charge or anything, but he's such a big fan of Seve, he went to all his events. And I also sold him the golf buggy that Colin Montgomery rode in when we won the Ryder Cup at the Celtic Manor, signed by all the players, and that's on a plinth outside his golf club. So go to this golf club, it's somewhere in Cork.
The one time I wish I had my waffles.
This is an interesting story. Don't give me waffle.
Moving on.
Okay, moving on. Right, Badu Watch. What's happening with our dear friend, A View to Akil Badu? For those who don't remember, we decided to follow the career of this wonderful young man that was the place for the Detroit Tigers after he had the most amazing opening night,
debut start.
Yeah,
but he's back now.
He's still
the Tigers. He went down to Toledo and they're a AAA affiliate, then he got called back up again because he's doing amazingly. And the month of August, you got the stats there, John. I'll let you read that.
He's played 19 games. He's hit 2 RBIs, 8 runs, no home runs, sadly, but he has stolen 3 bases with a batting average of .269. I'm just really relieved to read those stats, because when I asked you how's he getting on, I am absolutely sure you said, Eric, he's dead now. That's what I heard. Did you hear that, JC?
We'd have to say adieu, Badu.
How dark.
That is so awful. That is so wrong. And why am I laughing?
Well, he's
because it's so ugly, it's good. Come on,
give it to me.
Well, he beats someone within the month of September so far. He's 1 for 5.
Okay.
Can we do my Schreiber watch?
Oh, yeah.
Johnny Schreiber, who's now sort of seems to be the closer for the Red Sox, 7 saves. He has a 2.19 ERA. Everyone get on the Schreiber bandwagon. The guy is awesome.
For our listeners' sake, why are you such a fan?
Yeah, well, as you know, and I think I've mentioned this on the show a number of times. In fact, I interviewed him.
Hey, he's been on the show.
Yeah, he's been on our show. He has been, I think the first season I interviewed him for the show when he was still with the Tigers. He was my client when I was an agent and one of my last clients still out there, because it's now been quite a few years since I've represented players. And just a fantastic human, you know, you get into that business and a lot of players are prima donnas. He came from a really small school in Ohio, a late round draft pick, just a grinder and just, you know, turned himself into an elite relief pitcher, sidearm pitcher. Amazing. Just a great guy. Just a great guy. So, you know, whether we watch him or not, I mean, he's the first thing I look in the box scores every day to see if he's pitched, because, you know, I've had, you know, he was my guy and I represented him and he was just great. So.
It's a great story. Love it. And you love a grinder. Fantastic.
Always.
Or was that that website you used to go on?
No. All right, moving on. Oh.
Okay, we rang the bell just in time. It's batter number two, and our discussion is the Hall of Fame class of 2023, and I'm looking at my script here, and in very large letters, Eric has written lame. As we all know, 2022 was phenomenal. I mean, the most impressive lineup. And of course, that was all the discussion about Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds and all the, you know, will they get in despite the steroids, blah, 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 blah. And 2023 just couldn't be more unlike 2022. There's just literally not an interest. I mean, I'm looking at some of the names and I recognize, you know, pretty much all of them because they all played when we were doing the show. But these are not names, except for maybe Francisco Rodriguez or K-Rod, that you would even consider to be in the lineup. Would you?
But, I mean, I think that's what's so great about this is that this is our chance to take a second look at a lot of players who have been on the ballot multiple years. So right. This is the year for Scott Rolen. This is the year for Andrew Jones. You talk about K-Rod, but really Billy Wagner was one of the true, if you look at his advanced statistics, one of the true elite closers of all time. Yeah. Those guys are going to get a look. You're also looking at the final remnants of the people who were really at the center of the steroids era. And I think that now that we've set the precedent that neither Barry Bonds nor Roger Clemens got in, that, I mean, A-Rod is not going to find his way on there. I think Manny Ramirez is out of luck as well, too, because if either of those got in and you didn't let in Barry Bonds or Roger Clemens, doesn't seem to track quite right. But I think for Scotty Rolen, who I think is a bit of an underrated player when you look at him statistically, his defensive ability, his overall WAR, and to me, Andrew Jones, those two guys particularly. I know Todd Helton's another name. You know, he's got the curse of having played at Coors Field and what that impacts. But Larry Walker got in, so perhaps Helton will make his way too.
So just picking up on the points you're making, do you feel that Cooperstown undervalues defensive talent? Because a couple of the 100%. Names there, I mean, like Carlos Beltran is one of the names on this and, you know, renowned to be a great defensive center fielder. I think he recorded 40 defensive runs saved during his 14 seasons. But to put that in perspective, Andrew Jones, arguably in many people's eyes and certainly in mine for obvious reasons, the greatest defensive outfielder of all time, recorded 60 DRS in 14 years in center. And yet here he is still hanging in there hoping to get the vote. And do you feel that maybe it's a stat that just isn't given the value it deserves?
Well, I mean, it's always been harder to quantify, right? And the Hall of Fame's tried to make amends in certain instances. Bill Mazeroski, he was a player who was better renowned for his defensive ability. He ended up getting in the Hall of Fame a lot later. Obviously, Ozzie Smith was a player who was known for his defensive acumen. He got in off of that. Luis Aparicio, there are some exceptions to that rule. I think overall, you're seeing a voting body now in the Hall of Fame that's more savvy about it. And I think they're paying better attention. I think the issue with Andrew Jones, right, is when he was at his peak, he was, you know, indisputably a Hall of Famer. It's that he just fell off a cliff. Yeah. You know, his skill level for his peak era is comparable with other Hall of Famers, but he didn't have the longevity of greatness. And that's why he's a borderline. I think he's a Hall of Famer, but I think he's borderline for that reason.
And if you were asked to put your predicting hat on, you've just referenced the fact that the new intake is quite lame across the board. Therefore, it gives those that have sort of been hanging around for the last number of years and still eligible, commit yourself, put your head on the block. Give me a couple of names that you think, yeah, I think they will get in this time.
Yeah, I think Scott Rolen and I think Andrew Jones. Those would be my two. I think Billy Wagner, you know, you look at his WAR and just relief pitchers are undervalued. Helton was number two, I think, in the voting of the carryovers. So he might be borderline, but I still think that the Coors Field factor, and he was a first baseman, so, you know, doesn't have that same defensive element that, you know, even Larry Walker had in playing, you know, a more skilled, what's considered a more skilled position defensively, that he may not quite make it. So that'd be my guess.
Okay. And on the list that's just come out, who's the one that you just think, really? Is there one that sticks out like a sore thumb?
I mean, I think they're always, I think that for some players, it's just an honor to be on the ballot and that there is no expectation. You know, you have to actually meet a certain criteria in terms of years played and a certain level of performance. And so I remember Jim Deshaies, you probably would remember him, Gouldie. He was a pitcher for the Astros. I think he got like one vote and like he dined out on getting one Hall of Fame vote for like the rest of his retirement. You know, for some people, you know, your expectations are different depending on what your career was.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, good for him, though. I love the attitude.
The thing is, he has a precedent now because, like, Francisco Rodriguez, fourth all-time saves leader. You got to put him in because now the Hall's put in all these other relief pitchers who were, you know, 10th all-time, 12th all-time, 20th all-time, you know, so.
I sort of think for relief pitchers, though, Eric, that it's one position more than any other where the analytics piece really plays a big role. I mean, obviously Lee Smith is the exception to that rule because he was the leader for a bit. And I think he was so beloved. And you've met him before I've met him.
Exactly.
Like any person who meets him wants him to be in the Hall of Fame just on personality alone. But I think that as we get further and further in the process of normalizing relief pitchers into the Hall of Fame, that those sort of secondary categories, those analytics, you know, not just war, but like, you know, all the other sort of elements that are considered play a huge role.
By the way, if you look at the class of 2024 candidates, just, you know, you got Adrian Beltre, Chase Utley, Joe Mauer, Adrian Gonzalez. That's more than, you know, more of an impressive crop than 2023. So.
Beltre is a first ballot guy. I think definitely. That also Joe Mauer is going to get in. For sure, just because he did so much of his offensive stuff, behind the plate. Exactly.
Does Joe Mauer not make you feel old that he's actually up for eligibility? Because I remember him when he started. Like, I can't believe.
Gouldie, everything makes me feel old. Talking to you makes me feel old.
Well, because I look so good for my age. I understand.
You remember when Lou Gehrig was available for eligibility? Bartolo Colon, by the way, is another one for the class of 2024. So
Unless he makes his comeback, I'm still hoping.
And by the way, class of 2025, two big names, CC Sabathia and Ichiro.
First round pick.
We got to wait a while for that, though. So.
No hesitation. Ichiro, number one. No problems. Absolutely guaranteed.
Moving on.
Okay, well, batter three of three, and we're going to be looking at what has been described as the Interleague on steroids. Yes, they've come up with a suggestion that all 30 teams will face each other in a new format starting next evening, opening day, March the 30th, 2023. And obviously, Eric, you're such a big fan of Interleague. I imagine the whole concept of more, 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 you must be dancing in the aisles.
If anybody's listening to podcasts who has children in the room, you might want them to leave because I'll try not to use as many expletives and swear words, but fucking Interleague.
It's a family show.
It's a family show.
I'm assuming we'll have a bleep there. We're going to have to do some editing. But,
no, actually, it'll reinforce my love of it. Okay, now here's the thing. Okay, so let's look at the bozos at Major League Baseball who decide this would be a good idea to that every single player, all 20, every team will play all 29 other teams in one season, which means more interleague, which means, let's look at the basics here. We'll now have 46 interleague matchups compared to 20 in this season, 46 extra leagues. Now, they're introducing, you know, natural rivalries for interleague. Those natural rivalries that they're thinking are fantastic are Astros and Rockies, Tigers and Pirates, and Red Sox and Braves. How are those natural rivalries?
The Red Sox Braves, right?
Well, because of Boston.
The Braves are in Boston.
That's.
I mean, I vaguely get it. I mean, I'm with you on this, Eric. I mean, I got your back on this one. So
now think about divisional rivalry. Obviously, when they're trying to make it interesting for the wild card, but you know, when you're not having division, you're not playing against your divisional opponents, as we call them in the Premier League, six pointers, you know, where you actually want to be playing people in your own division towards the end of the regular season to make it worth it. So let's look at, you know, who's going to be playing the Tigers and or the Pirates or the Oakland A's or the Nationals when they're in this now run to the 2022 postseason, when they should be actually playing their own division.
Yeah, dude, you're spot on this one. I mean, I know like analysis is not your bag normally, but you nailed it. I mean, you look at
that's a mixed compliment of everyone.
I thought if I said it fast, we just keep on going.
No, it's I'm hurt. Go on.
Oh no, but I mean, you even raised the example of the Astros versus the Rockies. I mean, what are the odds that the Rockies are going to give the Astros any sort of actual competitive juice, right?
When the hottest ticket in town, exactly.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I like if everyone played everyone else equally, then I guess there'd be an equity issue that you could argue that at least like, okay, then you don't have those unbalanced games, but they're still doing that. It makes no sense. And it ruins one of the great fun of baseball, which is the postseason World Series clashing two different leagues. There might as well not be leagues anymore. I mean, what's the point?
We've lost the identity of what the National League is all about, what the American League is all about. It's the 25th anniversary of the Interleague, by the way. We've had the Interleague for 25 years. I miss those days where it was just, you know, where, I mean, let's look at it down this way. Goodbye to, you know, the double switch for pitchers. Obviously, I mean, now that they've introduced DH in both leagues, there's no identity of either National League or American League. The All-Star game means nothing now. Oh no, the American League, beat the National League.
It's the nature of corporatization, right? It's homogenizing everything. That everything is the same, and that, you know, there's no quirk, there's no kink, there's nothing interesting or different. And when you get so much similarity, it takes away some of the fun of sports. You know, when we saw, this is true of football, right? In the UK, when you see these big stadiums, like I miss Highbury, you know, instead of Emirates, or, you know, it's like, I love the quirk of sports, and these type of activities take it away.
But guys, both of you are missing the obvious here. Every decision made, and it doesn't matter what sport we're talking, rugby, football, cricket, baseball, NFL, every decision made is about money. Ultimately, yeah. It all comes back to the buck. And the reality is this decision's being made by MLB because they think it'll drive more interest, which ups TV revenue, which ups the amount of tickets that are being sold. You've got the same with Champions League football. In the great old days of the European Cup, you had to win your division to be in the European Cup. So they were truly champions. It's now called the Champions League, and yet the English league, you've got first, second, third, and fourth. What's champion about a fourth place team? It's a nonsense. But the reality, sadly for us, is that you lose the quality, you lose the nostalgia, but what you get back is greater money in the sport. Doesn't benefit us as fans, other than the fact that we're in much nicer stadiums. We're not, you know, when I used to go and watch rugby, England rugby at Twickenham, I mean, I have very, very keen memories of never being able to get into the toilet because the facilities were so bad and everybody's having a wee down the corridor. I mean, you know, that there are obvious gains that are made in terms of the comfort of the sport that's on offer. And I mean, maybe we're just being dinosaurs that we want to keep it like it used to be.
I'd be okay with that, Goldie, if they passed that along, didn't pass along the cost to the fans, right?
Yeah.
Which is a
yeah,
huge
that's part. A valid point. Yeah.
So all that happens, and yeah, they're making more money, but it's not like that money's trickling down. And we see that, right, with teams. They're willing to tank because they know they're getting their, you know, competitive balance money, and they don't care because they don't want to spend the money. Yeah. I would agree with you if I felt that ownership had the best interests of the sport in mind and the fan experience. But I don't see that happening. I know we sound like grumpy old men, like clearly.
Which we are.
But I think it's unfortunately in this instance, we're right.
Okay, yeah. Well, listen, I have no problems with their, okay, let's just make the month of June have like the fun, you know, whatever, like rivalries of Interleague. And then that's it. Just get rid of it in 1 month and I'll back to regular schedule programming with separating the AL and the NL. And before we close off this this segment, let me just do like, you know, a eulogy to what baseball used to be like. So I'm going to say, like, you know, goodbye to, you know, goodbye to double switches and pitchers batting for themselves. Goodbye to pinch hitters who get used properly. Goodbye to All-Star games that actually meant something. Goodbye to pitchers being pulled tactically for a pinch hitter. And goodbye to AL pitchers pitching for the first time in the National League ballpark in the World Series.
That was beautiful, buddy.
Well, I did.
It was almost poetic.
Yeah. Well, almost. Yeah. Almost.
Well, there you go. So I'll say one more time, fuck Interleague.
See, can I, buddy, we've known Eric for how many years? I mean, two decades plus. Have you ever known him? I mean, the most placid, gentle, kind man you could never meet greater than Eric Jensen.
And oh, yet, shut up.
We're seeing a side of him today.
I know. Where's the Canadian in him? Exactly. Yeah, the Canadian, he'd be saying sorry right now for such strong language.
That was a warning.
Okay. Well, let's get you back to where you're in your own little, you know, your own little happy place, which is, of course,
and
baseball.
Exhale.
Exhale. Seventh inning stretch, baseball book of the week.
Okay, so this week's baseball book of the week, which is very apropos. I like using that word apropos a lot in this broadcast, because we were just discussing Mickey Mantle's baseball card earlier. And I think it is apropos to recommend, written by Dave Jameson, Mint Condition.
Oh.
Which is a how baseball card basically got big, you know, the history of baseball cards. How Josh mentioned earlier, it started with tobacco companies, with Honus Wagner, how it became, you know, into society, and how he mentions the 1952 rookie card of Mickey Mantle in here. And even though this book is written 10 years ago, it's still relevant today, because it talks about the, as they call it, the junk wax era, where the bottom fell out and the market just collapsed in 1994 of baseball collectibles, as Josh would know.
Yeah. Just for people who are listening, I would love to do a podcast. So if there anyone to do a British podcast on baseball cards, I'm in. So just give me a call. I'm trying to pimp myself for a gig. But if you want to know the sets, for people who don't know baseball cards, let me just tell you the greatest sets of all time. 1933 Gaudi set, beautiful. 53 Tops, beautiful. And my favorite sort of lesser known set is the 1935 to 36 Diamond Stars set. So those are the sets, you know, you should go out and at least get one card from, because they rock.
Presumably that boat has sailed, though. I mean, anybody collecting a modern day card now, they're not going to be worth much come.
Well, they are. There's a period in the 90s and the 80s, really 80s and 90s, where baseball card collecting had a huge glut, and really the prices are very depressed for those periods.
Yeah.
But right now there's a huge collection interest. Nick Geller, Geltner, who we used to all work with, who was the associate producer, he does these box breaks where he'll go online and you pay money and they open up a box and you get a pack, and like you can end up getting cards that are worth thousands of dollars, brand new cards. It's got sort of like that, you know, the tulip bubble of, you know, the Dutch tulip bubble. Like, cards have that again right now, where they're new cards. It's not just baseball, though. Basketball, there's a huge interest in basketball cards. But right now, actually, new cards, if you get the right one, are worth thousands upon thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Baseball cards, I mean, they're pieces of art. If, you know, not modern day ones, but the sets I was talking about, if you go back, they're hand drawn, they're beautiful. Like, I appreciate that. I'm not interested in a picture of a player photographed. There's nothing really artistic about that. But beyond that, there's no utility other than just their pieces of cardboard.
Because we covered this story last year, didn't we? That Topps lost the contract. Is that right? Exactly. If I go back the right way?
So do you think and then they got bought out. They got bought out.
So which is gutting. Obviously, Topps was what Josh grew up with. And in Canada, we had this.
OPG.
OPG was. So hockey cards by OPG are more of value in the States and Canada, while baseball cards by Topps are more valuable in both the States of Canada, even though the OPG made both, which is also explained in this book, by the way. And also what else is explained is that Marvin Miller, he helped negotiate how Topps would actually pay off players as well. You know, players would benefit from baseball cards. And one more thing as well. What almost broke the internet last week, Ken Griffey Jr. reenacted. He found the exact same cap, jersey, and necklace that he wore with his rookie card. And
that, that was considered one of the most valuable cards that was, at the time.
At the time, there's 89.
A whole story about that is that they overprinted it because they just figured if they kept on churning it out, that it would help value for their cards. Interesting sort of side story to that Marvin Miller story, Eric, which was what happened to scabs, players who had crossed the picket line during the strike in, what, 94? Mm-hmm. Those players couldn't get baseball cards because all of the royalties and the relationship between Topps and the other baseball card companies were with the Players Association.
That's right.
Those players weren't allowed in the Players Association. They didn't get baseball cards.
Wow. Interesting bit of history.
So that's awesome. The baseball book of the week, Mint Condition by Dave Jameson. There you go.
Brilliant. What about your cultural reference this week, Eric? Please tell me it's not.
Oh, you're in for
No. Please tell me it's not musical. Go down the movie road, whatever you want to do. Read some poetry. Please tell me we're not going down the baseball music.
You're in for a treat today, Johnny, because for all you Red Sox fans out there like Josh who are wallowing in self-pity and already thinking the magic number's up and that there will be no postseason at Fenway this year, here's something to cheer you up. Taking you back to 1967, a song about somebody who's never made it to the World Series, or sorry, who never won the World Series, I should say, and it goes something like this.
Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, the man they call Yes, we love him. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, what power he has. Our Boston team is always on the beam, cause we got Yes. We Fenway fans, we stomp and clap our hands, and Yes is Yes. Rival pitchers on the mound all shake. They dread each windup that they have to take. When number 8 is standing at the plate, and then he swings. Whoa! There it goes again. Wow! There it goes again. Wow! There it goes again. A rival batter hits one off the wall, and there's Yastrzemski going for the ball. They try for two, the runner knows he's through. Ah, look at Yes! Whoa, he threw him out again. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, the man they call Yes. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, he's the idol of Boston.
I don't know what to say, buddy. Where do you... It's a song that is hoping by mentioning someone famous gives it a reason to exist.
It's nostalgic.
It's 1967. It's not nostalgic. It's just bad.
Carl Yastrzemski, a song written, by the way, Carl Yastrzemski, grandfather of
Mike.
Well, Giants, Mike Yastrzemski.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1989. I'm not questioning
And my favorite player growing up. I was a super collector of cards. And I told Eric before the show, I'm shocked I'd never heard this song before. And as much as I want to love, this is going to be heresy. I actually like the Mickey Mantle song better than I like this one. There was like a little polka vibe in this one and then some jazz. It didn't quite do it for me, but I think it's really cool. There was I mean, you got to give credit to any songwriter who can put the word Yastrzemski in a song and make the song actually come off.
That says everything about the song. The mere fact that you're putting the most ridiculous, unrhymable word in a song is exactly why the song should not exist in the first place.
Now, by the way, the singer-songwriter of Carl Yastrzemski, the song, is a guy called Jess Kane, who sadly passed away a while ago. Used to be a radio DJ and morning radio in Boston, but also was an actor in Bilko, the Phil Silver Show.
Love it.
And he came out with this beautiful, nostalgic soliloquy.
And this is a massive, hardcore Boston Red Sox fan. So basically, he created this appalling excuse for a song as a way to meet his hero. Is that what you're telling us?
It's
At least there's some justification for it, if that's the true story.
Now, here's the thing. Karl Yastrzemski. You know, he's still alive nowadays. I'm sure people sing it to him as he walks down the street.
Again, I'm shocked I didn't know the song. You said Erika came out in 67, which was the year he won the Triple Crown, right? So makes sense. I mean, he was on top of the baseball world that year, and they went to the World Series that didn't win, lost to the Cardinals.
And the good news is, after this segment, when the show's over, Johnny has to throw this song in its entirety.
Yay!
I could cope with that because, as we all know, he spent his entire 23-year career as a Boston Red Sox, which I love. I love loyalty. He hit 452 career home runs. The man was a great, great baseball player. You're absolutely right. He is still alive, by the way, he's just turned 83. His birthday
Thank God for Wikipedia, right? Now, absolutely. Now, here's the thing. It's like he actually has a record which now will never be broken because of effing Interleague. Has the record for most games played in the American League. Not consecutive, but most games played in the American League.
I mean, what was amazing about him was the longevity of his career. I got to meet him. You know, you always worry about meeting your childhood heroes, right? And I met him in the bowels of Anaheim Stadium back in the days before Interleague, when the Red Sox were playing the Angels. And it was kind of a disappointment, I won't lie. He wasn't the friendliest of guys. He was a little cold. He did sign my baseball cards that I still have. Even though I sold my whole collection, I kept the signed rookie and a signed second year card. My two heroes were him and Rich Gedman, who was the catcher at the time, who was beyond lovely when I met him. So Rich Gedman still remains in my pantheon of great baseball heroes from my childhood.
You said it yourself, JC, you should never meet your heroes, but I've been so blessed because Peter Bonetti, as we know, was my childhood hero. He was the loveliest human being in the history of lovely.
For those who don't know who Peter Bonetti is.
The Cat, Chelsea Football Club from the 70s, legend, played for England.
Again, I love the baseball reference. Yeah, go on.
Then there's Andy Ripley, rugby. Was my all-time favorite. Used to play for Rosslyn Plant, England, back in the 70s. Met him, very sadly, only months before he died of cancer. What a lovely human being.
Just name-dropping now, Gordon.
No, I'm like telling you that, unlike you, buddy, I've got three all-time favorite sportsmen. There's two. The third one, the Chip. And, of course, we've got to interview the Chip at the Hall of Fame game back in 2004 when the Twins were playing the Braves, and he was utterly delightful.
Yeah, I don't know.
What? By the way,
I'm joking. I'm so joking. I just want to see your reaction.
by the way, just to close this off, Pete Rose owns the record overall for most games played in Major League Baseball with 3,562. That's both a baseball record and a National League record, while Karl Yastrzemski owns the American League record with 3,308.
We should also point out that that Carl was also the first player to collect over 3,000 hits and 400 home runs solely in the American League. So, I can see why he was your hero, buddy, even if he turned out to be a bit of a knob.
Yeah. Okay. No, he was a great
show,
player.
Johnny, please, come on.
now you want to clean the show off, Eric.
So there you go. That's we'll be playing that song again. By the way, just another side story. My neighbor, when I was a kid, he was the first one on our block to get a VHS recorder. And I remember going to the shop and buying a VHS tape, and because I wanted to tape This Week in Baseball. And that song was on it, my first ever recording of This Week in Baseball. And I played it over and over again. And I memorized that song when I was a kid, as a teen. And I annoy everybody in high school just walking down the hall, was going, "Ah, Yastrzemski." And, I was told to shut up a few times. But
yeah, you didn't even like the Red Sox. That's
No, but
I love baseball.
But I love baseball. Exactly.
So you already knew how irritating the song was, and yet you've still imposed it upon our podcast.
I'm surprised I didn't get laid more. That's it.
Boy, we've gotten blue. And it's too early for it.
And you saw you missed David. Moving on.
Moving on, trivia answer, please. Remind everybody of the question, Eric.
Okay, so I asked you earlier about pitchers who have thrown the most games with 10 or more strikeouts.
Yes.
And the options I gave you were Pedro Martinez, Roger Clemens, or Max Scherzer.
Yeah.
I will let Josh go first.
Great pitchers. I feel like I've read something recently on this, though. And I think, shockingly, I think this is one of those misdirects, Goldie. where you think, oh, it's got to be Clemens, it's got to be Petey. Scherzer's good, but he's not great. But I'm actually going to go with Scherzer for that reason. I'm going to confound the question.
Okay, I'm still going to stick with my own instincts based on not just a high strikeout pitcher, but also longevity of career. I think Scherzer's had a lot of injuries. I'll be amazed. I know he's been around a long time, but he has also been injured a lot. So I'd be amazed if it was him. So I'm going to stick with my first instinct. When you asked the question, I was sitting there going, it's got to be Roger Clemens. So I'm sticking with Clemens. Eric?
In no particular order.
Here we go. Come on!
Pedro Martinez. 108 games with 10 or more strikeouts.
Very good, but not good enough.
Max Scherzer, 110 games.
All right. I'm still in.
You're in with a shout.
Yes.
Roger Clemens, 3. No. No. Roger Clemens, 110 games as well.
No!
So, at the time of recording, Roger Clemens and Max Scherzer at both 110 games. Max Scherzer sees one more 10 or more strikeouts game that, and then he surpasses Roger Clemens.
Plays for a rubbish team.
So at the today you are right, Johnny, with joint with Josh, but soon you will be wrong because he will.
No way. He's never having another 10 strikeout game.
You're cursing him for your own vanity, Gould.
100%. Who's he play for? Of course I'm cursing him. We haven't even discussed the National League.
Tell you what, I'm going to throw in a bonus trivia here. Also active right now. Which one of these three active players who are, you know, after besides Max Scherzer, have 10 or more strikeout games? Is it Chris Sale, Justin Verlander, or Clayton Kershaw?
Ooh, tell us. Verlander.
Just tell us. Yeah, I'll go with Kershaw just to be different.
It's actually Chris Sale. You're both losers. Love it. 78.
Good old we.
78. Well,
that's one, you know, he will not end up at the end of his career higher than the other two because Sale doesn't have much left in the tank.
He'll probably injure himself cycling again or something. So,
yeah.
Do you ever ask yourself, how do we justify doing this podcast?
Because no one gets paid. That's
what people don't. Fans do as well.
Okay, great stuff. Well, we move into the final moments of the game, everybody. The fans are leaving the stadium. The popcorn's on the floor. But we will be back, and we need you to help us pump up the Johnny and Josh Show on Twitter, on Facebook. Big up our social handles, as always, at the bottom of the screen. Hit them if you can, particularly if it says like. And don't forget to watch the Nat Coombs Show at the NC Show. And that'll be talking NFL, which, of course, is kicking off, about to kick off. In fact, I, tonight, am doing my NFL fantasy draft, boys.
Oh,
I
didn't even mention that. God.
Yeah. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're on YouTube. It's been lovely having you company. What have you got to look forward to for the rest of the month, boys?
Curling season started, guys. We have a very ambitious slate. If anyone out here listening would like to sponsor a top 10 US curling team, you can get your name. It could be the Johnny Gould team. We just put Johnny Gould across our jerseys.
What are you looking for? So what, a couple of bottles of water and some Mars bars?
Some
what
pocket lint would probably be good. The week after next weekend is my birthday, and the weekend after that is my first tournament. We're going to Whitby, Ontario to play in an event.
But we've got a local Martin Dias. I can get you some brooms. Would that help?
Yes, they're not of the style that I've grown accustomed to, Gouldy. Wrong kind of broom. But thank you, though.
Okay. Well, best of luck, that buddy. Anything planned for your birthday? Anything nice?
No, nothing planned. It's, as you know, because I'm exactly 10 years younger than you, right? So it's 51.
51, so the big 5-1. Kind of
just another year.
Yeah, people struggle to believe that, to be honest, that age difference. Anyway, let's move it on. Eric, how about you? What are you up to, buddy?
Well, I'm glad you asked because I've been preparing myself for this. I'm going to Newcastle this weekend, and I'm actually doing the Great North Run.
No. Well, filming it. You're not running it.
For the BBC, yeah.
Yeah. You're not running it, buddy. No offense. No, you couldn't.
I'll probably have a stroke after crossing the bridge. And Johnny, what are you doing this weekend?
I'm back in the saddle, guys. I'm back in the saddle work-wise. As you know, the summer's pretty low for me. I'm back in the saddle. I've got three jobs. I'm doing a big golf day. And I'm very excited. I'm going to Dublin in Ireland on Saturday. I'm flying to Dublin in Ireland, where I'm hosting an auction for a famous Irish rugby player. Now, I've done auctions in front of the Irish community in London, and they're always, as you can imagine, a bit of a crack. I've never, ever done one actually in Ireland. So this is a market I've wanted to break for a long, long time. So I'm very excited, very pumped. If it goes well, sky's the limit. As we all know, the Irish are a great, great nation, great characters. So fingers crossed, boys. I'll let you know next time we do the podcast how it goes. But yeah, lots to look forward to. Lots of great events, very exciting events. I live a very blessed life. I enjoy my life enormously. So thank you.
I love the cliffhanger. I love the cliffhanger. We'll see how it goes.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. I raised 50 pounds, 50 euros.
I sold a bag for 50 pounds.
Absolutely.
50 euros.
Well, boys, thank you so much for your time. As ever, it's been an absolute pleasure and a real laugh. And obviously, very little of this is going to be actually making the final edit, given the fact that we don't go out post the watershed at 9 p.m. Eric has destroyed any possibility of this being a family show. But we hope you've enjoyed listening, as we've enjoyed doing. We'll be back, hopefully, in about a month's time. We'll be nearing the postseason, so still lots to talk about. If you want baseball, if that is your favorite thing, then you know there's only one place to come, and that is the Johnny and Josh podcast with Eric making an appearance. From us, thank you and goodbye. We'll see you next time. Till then, we leave you with this diatribe.
Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, the man they call Yes, we love him. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, what power he has. Our Boston team is always on the beam, cause we got Yes. We Fenway fans, we stomp and clap our hands, and Yes is Yes. Rival pitchers on the mound all shake. They dread each windup that they have to take. When number 8 is standing at the plate, and then he swings. Wow, there it goes again. Wow, there it goes again. Wow, there it goes again. A rival batter hits one off the wall, and there's Yastrzemski going for the ball. They try for two, the runner knows he's through. Ah, look at Yes! Whoa, he threw him out again. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, the man they call Yes. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, he's the idol of Boston, Mass. On Beacon Hill, he gives them quite a thrill. In Southie, too, there's lots of whoop-de-doo in the North End. They call Carl friend, and they hope the season will never end. From Wellesley Way, they come to watch him play, and on Cape Cod, they take a holiday from all about. They come to shout, yell for Yes to hit one out. The state of Maine is going quite insane, and in Vermont, it's only Yes they want. From every state, they come and wait to see Yastrzemski at home plate. Our Boston team, it's always on the beam, cause we got Yes. We Fenway fans, we stomp and clap our hands, and Yes is Jazz. Although Yastrzemski is a lengthy name, it fits quite nicely in our Hall of Fame. We love him so. In Boston, we all know that when he swings, yeah, here we go again.